So how might we do therapy in terms of dealing with trauma? Well, there's a lot of different ways we can approach this. Cognitive behavioral therapy on many levels with anxiety or depression, with any of these disorders we're talking about today, can be useful. After we laid a foundation for teaching about those red flags, what to watch out for, the warnings, the concerns, and then how to test that out, we can teach them the cognitive debating skills. We can help them look at what are alternative, healthier behaviors that they can choose. Art therapy can be very useful, not just with kids, but also with adults, art and play therapy. Because with art therapy, we can use a lot of the somatic sensations and feelings that are hard to put into words a lot of times when they're trauma. Imagine flinging paint on a canvas. Imagine being able to sense and use that motion with the clay and the manipulating the different sorts of art supplies. That can be very freeing for people. We can also provide some education about things like how the body keeps score in PTSD, about how it affects the developmental stages. Sometimes you may need to teach some coping skills. How do I manage interpersonal relationships? How do I avoid the all or nothing thinking and going to extremes between this hypervigilance and this hypoarousal? We might have to do some exposure-based preventions. Again, if certain things are being avoided, we know avoidance in the long run and the extremes is not helpful. In the short run, it might give some momentary relief. Oh, I don't have to deal with it if I'm not looking at it, if I'm not, you know, having to face it hands on. But in the long run, it actually really does more harm than good. So teaching people how to actually face things. We might use something like systematic desensitization, kind of like the subjective units of distress, rating things from 0 to 100, and then teaching relaxation, progressive muscle relaxation to kind and breathing techniques to try and just decrease the unhealthy arousal level so that the memories, the thoughts, the assumptions of the worst, the reliving can be dealt with in a more healthy way if we're going to do exposure-based prevention. It can be helpful to also involve the systems in therapy. So if we're working with a traumatized kid, it's often helpful to work with the parents as well, to do like parent-child dyadic therapy. If we're dealing with a traumatized adult and they're in a relationship with a significant other in their life, it can be helpful for them also to sometimes have that significant person in their life involved in how to support them. Because sometimes it's hard for the other person to understand. They may think, well, just do A, B, and C. Just don't think of it so much. Just don't react so strongly. They may not understand why such a strong reaction. Writing exercises can be helpful too, because with issues like shame, sometimes if we put things into words and we can help with working on the narrative, when we tell the story, it disempowers it. The parts that are traumatic, when we bring them to light and we have someone else like a therapist walking alongside us, wow, now they just don't have the sting they did before. So there's several types of treatments. We can help a client bridge the gap between the mind-body dichotomy, which is awesome. Often something that they come in with. We can help them bridge that gap and bring the body sensation into focus and process them under safe conditions. We can use this narrative therapy to empower a client to see, you know, not all the chapters of your life have been written. Yes, we can acknowledge and validate the hurts, the pains, the shame that may have to do with the narratives to this point. But there's parts of the story that are ongoing. We can help them essentially make a shift in locus of control. Look at what they can realistically influence. Again, not necessarily control, but they can influence or shape. Some of the areas I'll highlight with clients, for example, in narrative therapy, are you got to pick who the characters in the story are. Just because someone was in your life and you felt that they caused certain reactions doesn't mean you have to decide to continue to have them in your life from here. You can choose another option. You can choose how close you want to be with them or the nature of that relationship. One of the other techniques we hear a lot about in terms of PTSD is what they call body awareness and mapping techniques. So a variation of this that oftentimes works is to trace an outline of the patient's body onto a heavy paper and then have them color or draw in things that represent areas of feelings, thoughts, or sensations. As we go through, and I make reference to this article by Crawford, there's questions we can use with the clients to assist them in processing and bringing to awareness some of these things that they may be trying so hard to push out of awareness. Things like, how do you feel today as you're doing this? What kind of feelings are coming to mind? What is the symbol that represents this? Who supports you? How do you see yourself? What are some of your strengths, or what they call power points? What can you draw strength from? Where in the body might you be feeling what you've gone through? Because sometimes traumatic experiences can be felt in the body, so it wouldn't be out of the norm or atypical for you to feel tightness in your muscles, for you to feel like certain parts of your body ache or twitch or do different things in reaction to the thoughts or memories of what's traumatic for you. Other things that could be focused on are examples of if the client does things like black out. What happened when you blank out or black out? What techniques do you use to remind yourself in the moment that I'm here in the present and the here and now? That can be a hard one. So mindfulness can be really helpful when their body sensations are taking a client to different places. What would you like the future to be? How can we get there? Now, anxiety may look a little different. We talked a little about kids. The elderly may experience anxiety in a particular way. Sometimes the anxiety for an elderly person can be worse and even more debilitating than for other ages because it really hits their self-esteem. They become acutely aware of the reduction in their activity level. They can't physically get around the way they could before. The amount of stimulation and the stimuli around them can affect them in different ways that it might have when they were younger. They may be aware of this layer of grief that tends to co-occur with anxiety, this issue of processing the loss of friends and relatives, the loss of physical independence and chronic diseases that tends to be a layer upon things. When we're talking about health issues, that can cause PTSD too. A lot of times, you know, we hear about abuse and trauma, about emotional abuse, domestic violence, sexual abuse. But do you ever think about just health issues being traumatic? For example, I have a young man now who has so many food allergies that having to build his life and plan his day around what in the world is left that he can eat is traumatic for him. He's only in high school and he's having to do this. It really can impact your sense of identity. But think of with the elderly with a predisposition just because of age alone to some physical limitations, their anxiety may be even higher. They're aware of changes in their daily life or their living environment. There's fears of death or limitations in social support, which are really important elements of therapy. We talked about narrative therapies a little bit, but part of it is helping our clients just to reconstruct their story. We're all born based on this thing the literature would call the assumptive world theory. The idea that when we're a child, we come into the world thinking it's a nice, good, happy place. Good things happen to good people. Bad things happen to bad people. The world is mostly safe. People are nice. People are well-intentioned. But over time in life, we realize, ooh, there are real problems in society. Not everybody is so great. There are real issues to face. And particularly if a client's experienced things as a trauma, they're definitely feeling that way. They're having that helplessness. They're having that war between, is the world safe? Is it a good place? Or maybe it's not. And maybe it's actually a pretty bad place, a pretty uncomfortable place, a pretty anxious place. So they're looking at how livable is my world anymore. That's an interesting concept to discuss with a client. The life that I'm having now compared to the life I maybe wanted to have. How's that going? So we're helping the client to create a livable world. Another phrase they use in the literature is to help them to make the unthinkable thinkable. Just like I said, by putting things into words, that alone can be empowering for many people. We're helping them to develop new narratives. Restoring is one phrase they use in the literature. I'm going to read a reference from an article that I think really summarizes this concept of learning to reapproach life when there's been trauma. You can look at what happened to you. It was truly horrible, but it's not unthinkable or unfaceable. You do not have to run from it day and night. And you do not need to totally curtail your life for fear of a reoccurrence. You can live in a world where this once happened and where there's a remote chance it could happen again. Moreover, you must look at it. You must face it. Because what is happening now is what happens if you don't. So the keys we want to highlight when we're working with clients is as a therapist, we can help co-create a new reconstructed past. We can remind a client that these events really are located in the past. We can elicit disclosure of the story in a safe environment. The story is no longer unthinkable. It no longer has to be pushed away. And we can demonstrate that someone does in fact understand. Variations of restoring can be giving homework assignments like expressive writing, And just even sort of like drama or role play sort of things about what role do I want myself and other people to be in? How will this play out over time? Narrative therapies are known to help draw a client's attention to positive aspects of a situation. Imagine if a client, through their anxiety, has spent most of their time practicing the negative. The idea of just telling the client, oh, pay attention to the positive, it's not going to happen if they're not used to doing that. So we need to teach them how to do that. And we can definitely use narrative therapies to do that. Narrative therapies have been shown to decrease levels of depression and anxiety. We might have to use what I'd say is guided attention in terms of helping remind a client in the moment that he or she has the ability and the power to choose things. I find with many of my clients, when they first come into me, they use a lot of language that has a lot of have-tos in it. I have to do this. They feel trapped. But one of the biggest reconstructings that I do is helping reconstruct the language and make that change or shift from have to choose to. There are options. You might not feel you have many options, but you do have some. Another type of therapy that sometimes can be used is reality therapy. So this is based on the choice theory of Glasser. So instead of blaming others for what they've done, we can look at what can I do from here. Now, when I say we don't blame others, the first thought might come to your mind or a client's mind is, yeah, but someone did do this to them. So there's a difference between blaming and validating the reality of what happened. We certainly want to validate a client's narrative, the feelings, the legitimate parts of it. But dwelling on and picking apart what the other person did isn't going to help them move forward either. So we want to resist blame. We want to help the client shift to some level of locus of control where they can be empowered to support the clients in their choices in controlling, quote unquote, more like influencing their life. So there's four key questions that we find when we're using a reality therapy approach with clients. What do you want from life? What would your quality or ideal world look like? A variation of that, which I use with clients, is, you know, if you could have three wishes, what would be happening? Second, is what we are doing helping you get to this? Third, let's evaluate your total behavior and see if this is useful and helpful. And then four, make a plan to really construct your reality. I also include in the PowerPoints, which I made reference to a little bit ago, this therapy approach called systematic desensitization. So after we build rapport, we want to always hear the client's narrative. What to them constitutes their presenting concern and their potential solutions. Then putting their concerns, putting their memories, especially with regards to trauma, in a subjective rating scale between 0 to 100. I give the example about one of my clients who had been raped on her job, and she worked at a retail store. For her, if we were rating from 0 to 100, receiving a coupon in the mail for a sale at that store would be a 20 or 30 on her stress level already out of 100. Seeing a commercial on TV about that store would also be pretty stressful. 100 or an 80 might be driving by the particular store that she did work at where she says certain things happened. Or going to another store or business in the area of that. What we want to do is pair the memories that are uncomfortable of these events with relaxation, with things that physically de-escalate. So then there's less likelihood of avoidance. One of the other types of anxiety we might see with clients, in addition to generalized anxiety, obsessive compulsive anxiety, PTSD, and some of these things we've talked about already, might be social phobia. And the idea is there's such this sense of evaluation of other directedness, of what I'm worried they might think of me. So it's not necessarily that they are thinking it, but again, just like with other anxiety disorders, the social phobic person estimates the level of threat as much higher than it really is. There's marked and persistent fears of social situations. There's concerns that I might be scrutinized by others. There's presumptions about judgment and being rejected. There's anticipation of others not liking me. And so as a result, there's people, especially at extreme levels, who end up avoiding. And this is where we can see things even as severe as agoraphobia, where someone will be housebound. So what happens is sometimes they hyperfocus on certain cues in the environment to the absence of others. They have this bias for things that they think support the shame. I'm going to mess up. They won't like me. They're looking at me. They're going to think this of me. And the fact of the matter is there could be many other explanations. So we're helping clients learn to look at the different explanations. So first we build rapport. Then we help to accept the client's world and test it out and see if the assumptions are accurate or not. So we're investigating into that. And then we're assisting the clients in terms of making sense of these inner experiences. One of the types of therapy the literature speaks about quite a bit is that of cognitive restructuring. So we're helping a client identify and change their dysfunctional beliefs, their thoughts, that are often automatic. Like I said, if they've spent years practicing something, it's going to take some time to undo that. So we're going to help them over time identify those thought patterns that aren't useful or helpful. We're going to maybe even use that questioning. Tell me a little more about how useful this is or isn't to you. Is this working? Is this helping? Is it helping you get closer to your goals? And ultimately assisting the client in terms of replacing anxiety-producing thoughts with more socially adaptable thoughts. Over time, we'd teach some cognitive debating skills. So we're helping them challenge the veracity of assumptions regarding social situations. We're looking at their anxiety, their negative self-evaluations, or fears of evaluation by others. So one of the lines of questioning I found useful with clients in terms of this cognitive restructuring is asking them the question, what would that mean? So let's say a client does have social anxiety and they say, oh man, I don't know if I want to go to that event. I know everyone's going to be watching me. Okay, let's talk more about that. What would that mean? What would that mean if people were watching you? Even if it wasn't everybody, but if someone was looking your way and really attuned to how you look or act or whatever, what would that mean? Oh, that would mean they can tell how I am inside. They know how nervous I am. They know how awkward I am. They can just tell. They can see how weak and inferior. Wow, so they know you're a flawed person. So they'd find out that you're not as all together as maybe you thought you were. Yeah, they would know I'm flawed. So what would that mean? Well, it would mean that I don't know that I could show my face around there because they'd know how imperfect I am, and why would I want people to see that? Oh, so if you had any flaws or mistakes, people with flaws, people who make mistakes, people, instead of mercy, they just better not show their face. So I might even create a joke or use a sense of humor and say, oh, so if one of your friends was hanging with you and they made a mistake, you would prefer them just to stay home and not go out with you? And oftentimes my clients will laugh and say, well, no, of course, they're human. Oh, so actually, if you were in a social situation and someone noticed something about you, even something uncomfortable, it might mean that you're human. It might mean that you're a person, just like the other people. It might mean that instead of their scrutinizing you and finding out your flaws, they might find that you're actually a real person too. Oh, huh. And imagine what perspective that gives to a client. Sometimes we have to have a little talk with our clients. I've had to do this many times. And help them realize that part of the solution is what's uncomfortable. Part of it involves exposure. Without actually allowing themselves to approach what they fear, they can't find exceptions to the situation. They can't face the feared situations and learn how to redirect. A variation of this cognitive reframing is also the social reappraisal therapy. So, a lot of times, like I said, people with anxiety tend to have a negative threat bias. But we can help them look at their high standards, their perfectionistic standards. We can help them look at, are they really excessively self-focused? Are there any social skills they might want to build up? We can role play practices and sessions. We can actually assign things like homework to, on a small level, create social mishaps. Practice being human. Wow. That might seem odd at first. The therapy office can be a center where we can demonstrate mercy to our clients. Where we can show them, by the way we react to the narratives they bring in, that it's okay to be, quote, flawed. It doesn't have to bring shame. It doesn't have to mean you're a flawed person. We can help them reappraise things and reframe them. We can offer supportive and expressive therapy. Oftentimes this could be several sessions of helping them look at what they're hoping to get to, their wishes. Things like, oh, I wish people would like and approve of me. Okay, we can validate that. That's a real human desire. So, what's your fear? You're afraid that if you're in a situation, you might find out that, yeah, I might find out that they don't completely like everything about me. Okay, and let's talk about what would be the worst thing about that. Let's talk about other ways of looking at it. So we can convey warmth and acceptance, support. We can use those rapport building techniques, high levels of Rogers process variables all throughout the therapeutic process. We can build the sense of we and the mutual restoring. We can put into words things like discrepancies or patterns which keep social anxiety, embarrassment, or shame going. We can also teach clients to manage things in terms of smaller steps. Sometimes they're wanting to get to and arrive at this better place quickly, but teaching them realistic steps. We can allow room for them to express things without condemnation in our office. This helps reflect our common humanity. We're normalizing feelings, even unpleasant feelings. Unpleasant doesn't mean wrong. Unpleasant doesn't mean shameful. Some of the belief systems that many of our clients have actually keep the anxiety going. They tend to devalue emotional expression. They tend to avoid tasks that increase vulnerability. They ruminate to the point that they build up a situation that may not happen or that they may actually succeed at if it does happen. Sometimes I'll actually even talk with the client about, okay, so what if that did happen? How would you handle it? Just planting the seed that you have managed, you have handled something in life before, can be very affirming to the client. But oftentimes we see things like rumination, blame, or shame. So alternative views that we can help a client see are things like emotional realism, allowing for and planning for discomfort and even disappointment in life. It doesn't have to mean shame. It can just mean that that other person has a different point of view. We can empower clients to take actions, like in the reality therapy type of approach we talked about a little bit ago, in spite of their worries. I remember telling a young man the other day in therapy who had anxiety. He was doing a lot of comparisons about himself and his brother and wanting to be more like this brother he saw as so successful all the time. And I told him, I said, you know what? I really admire the fact that you continue to do things even while you feel worried. I think that takes a lot more courage than doing things that come easy and automatic. And that really gave him a difference of perspective. Oh, my brother doing things that just come easy that don't stress him out? Yeah, I guess that doesn't take courage. Wow, what a different sense of perspective. Now, there's a type of therapy that they talk about in the literature. This was new to me. I hadn't heard of this type of therapy before, but they call it Morita therapy. M-O-R-I-T-A, Morita therapy. It's more of an Eastern technique, so it's probably something that might not generally be taught in our grad schools. But the idea of letting the client experience anxiety, kind of like mindfulness, letting it pass through, and helping the client to choose behaviors in spite of the inconvenient anxiety. So for the first 4 to 7 days, they have the client pretty much on bed rest. They don't choose much of anything. They just physiologically are at that very low level, just awareness, just only letting certain things in. Then light work, things like journaling, a diary, mindfulness things like observing nature, listening to motivational lectures, and then adding in, after 20 days, some simple tasks, and eventually learning to return to real life. So what Morita therapy highlights is the idea of what's most important to attend to? If I'm going to be mindful, how can I practice what's most important? Because the idea is I really, realistically, cannot attend to everything. As an anxious person, the more I'm attending to, the higher the anxiety goes. I need to find a different way of approaching this. So really, the theme I hope you're getting is that when we're dealing with clients with anxiety, the key we're doing is helping them to reconceptualize their cues. We're helping deal with emotions, helping identify emotions, learn to regulate them, helping them consider alternative explanations for things, helping them identify the contextual cues, and modify schemas that might have been there a while. We're allowing our clients to have some vulnerability and realize it's just part of being human. I love to always layer these other techniques with a solution-focused treatment, because solution-focused treatment, by its nature, is strengths-based. We use the imaginations of children. We use the idea of, ooh, the miracle question. If things could be better, what would that look like? Huh. So most of the time, what I fear is not really as bad as I think. So we use language like, how have you managed? When you coped better, what were you doing? So instead of talking more extensively and breaking apart all these issues of what went wrong, we're talking more about the coping. It really helps the client see, oh, I have coped. I have done problem solving. For some of our clients, we may need to actively even teach problem solving. How to identify goals. How to amplify exceptions. How to assign tasks to focus on the goals. And then evaluate. One of the types of disorders we didn't talk about, but kind of hinted at some of the symptomology at so far, is panic disorder. When we're talking about hypervigilance, that could also hit on panic. The idea with our clients with panic disorder is that they have a tendency to misinterpret their body sensations. If their heart's racing, if they have butterflies in their stomach, if they feel nervous and jittery, maybe their hands are shaky, they're interpreting that as, I'm having a heart attack. My body's out of control. I might be going insane. Dizziness might mean I'm going to faint. My body's just going down the tubes. So neutral things are perceived as negative. Ambiguous situations are interpreted as meaningful and negative. And so just because they're having increased arousal, they interpret it a certain way. So a lot of what we can do, first of all, is providing a psychoeducational approach. I had a client recently who mentioned about her anxiety. Now, she started with more of a generalized pattern, but then she was telling me how there were bouts every now and then of her heart racing and the panic kind of things. So we looked at understanding the role of why someone might have hypervigilance, understanding the fight, flight, freeze response, providing some education about that, but normalizing the idea of riding out the wave of anxiety. One of the things I'll teach my clients, when they tell me their ultimate goal is to not feel anxious, I may have to kind of correct them and provide some education about in life is probably going to make the anxiety worse if we're saying don't be anxious. What might be more realistic is to say you're going to be anxious. So let's learn ways of preparing to manage when it does happen, because it will. Doesn't mean you're a bad person. It's not personal. It's just part of life. So learning to get rid of anxiety is not the goal. So we're helping them deal with automatic, negative, unpleasant assumptions about themselves, about what their body sensations mean, the comparisons of themselves to others. Some people, their panic gets so bad that they get to a point of being agoraphobic where they just stay in. There's a number of techniques that are virtual reality based or exposure based. So there's a lot of literature that shows that instead of practicing avoidance, if we can help a client to practice in very small steps with relaxation, with some of these other techniques, approaching things, that they can learn that maybe it's not as awful as they anticipate. Wanted to just address a few other possible types of therapy to give you a real broad toolbox for dealing with these clients. You see, what we're doing little by little, we're cultivating an environment in the therapy session to help the client realize, I believe in you. You can get past this. We're going to get through this. One type of approach that I love as I study more is this acceptance and commitment therapy, which is abbreviated ACT, A-C-T. With acceptance and commitment therapy, the idea is helping increase the regulatory function of anxiety. The anxiety, again, itself may still be there, but we're teaching a client to accept rather than try to push away and fight against anxiety. So acceptance is the willingness to experience their inner state regardless of whether it feels pleasant or unpleasant. It's just passing through. I love using the word just because it immediately gives the client an idea of, oh yeah, it's only anxiety. It's not, woo, it's anxiety. It's just anxiety. Diffusion is another word you may hear if you're reading about this acceptance and commitment therapy. So practicing how to perceive thoughts in a neutral way. Just because I think it, just because the idea comes to my mind, doesn't mean it has to be absolutely true. One of the things the literature talks about is being the observing self. So being like looking at situations as a third party and observing as opposed to just letting things happen to you. So the idea being learning how to live with mindfulness in the present moment, to attend to events in the here and now in an open, receptive, and non-judgmental way. A lot of times we find that the things that cause stress or anxiety for our clients oftentimes hit on their sense of values. There's something that was important to them that didn't go the way that they would like, or that they're worried might not go the way they like. So I might say to a client, oh, wow, sounds like you really have a strong sense of fairness about the situation being handled the way it quote-unquote should be. Oh, sounds like you believe such and such is really important to you. We can help identify a client's values, the way that they approach life or desire to live life, and then help them develop what they call committed actions towards those, or reasonable, rational goals. So we're helping them let go of the struggle against these inner experiences and allowing them to just be. We're helping them identify values and take life direction consistent with the values and to choose committed actions that are consistent with their values and chosen direction. So this, we can use this in connection with mindfulness. It regulates what we pay attention to, how we experience emotions. It helps test out the biases that we see in so many of our anxious clients. It helps our clients to remind themselves that, oh, I can just exist in the here and now. I can discover new ways of engaging with other people or with the environment. There's other sorts of variations in terms of mindfulness. One of them I found quite interesting that they did a study on that I reference in that literature is what they call the soap bubble study. They found that people in a waiting room at a hospital or a situation where they were anticipating being evaluated or their symptoms looked at or their discomfort had a high level of anxiety. But sometimes something like having soap bubbles around served as a useful distraction. That's pretty interesting. So what is it about the soap bubbles? So for one, when you think about bubbles, if someone's blowing bubbles, they have to breathe a certain way. They have to breathe slowly, consciously, mindfully. You can't really successfully blow a bubble if you're blowing hard, like really hard. You have to really focus and do mindful breathing. When you're doing that, they found that people had a lessened perception of pain. Their overall ratings of anxiety on anxiety scales were less. And they actually were able to anticipate the positive or consider that better. We can retrain our emotions. We can teach our clients that they don't have to pay more attention to the discomfort of the anxiety, but they can choose what to pay attention to. They can look at the context in which things occur instead of hyper-focusing and piecing them apart. They can put things in their cultural context. They can label their emotions, see the context, and recognize things in themselves and others. They can manage different contexts. They can basically look at, instead of having this expectation of never being anxious, that they can put anxiety in its proper perspective. To this end, like I said, we're helping clients look at what they're paying attention to. Now, we'll pick up here in our next section with things like art therapy and some other therapies. Like I said, I really just want to broaden your sense of all the different tools that are out there. Because for our clients, they feel very helpless and quote-unquote out of control. But it can be easy for us, if we're over-empathizing with them, to start to feel that ourselves. But what we can do is help them with all these different techniques to reattend to things a different way and to normalize that anxiety is a part of life. I wouldn't just say it that way to them, but basically that's what we're doing through these techniques, is instead of avoiding anxiety or hyper-focusing on it, we're putting it in the proper perspective.